Welcome to Gynecologic Oncology Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Robert Coleman, and to begin, he commented on two recent papers he co-authored focusing on the initial management of ovarian cancer and the evolving concept of optimal cytoreductive surgery and the decision, based primarily on laparoscopy, on whether to proceed directly to surgery or use neoadjuvant chemotherapy.
We feel very strongly that this is probably one of the key decision points in a patient who comes with a new diagnosis. We'd like all those patients, regardless of whether or not we feel like they're good candidates, to be at least evaluated by a gynecologic oncologist because of the importance of the surgical question. Our friends over in Germany did a really nice study where they collected about three of their essentially negative chemotherapy trials, and they looked at the outcomes of surgery across the conglomerate of that about 3,500 patient cohort. And they showed that while patients with less than a centimeter residual disease, which was previously called optimal, did better than those that had more than one centimeter disease, the real difference were the patients who had no visible residual. So what we did is we've kind of redefined what we consider as optimal. Optimal being that there's no visible residual. And what that did was that if you look at the cohort of patients going to surgery, we used to say about 75% of those could be made optimal with a good surgery. Now that number changes to about 25-30%. And what we tried to do is figure out a way to increase that number. And that's kind of what led to this personalized approach to surgery.
What are some of the elements that go into what you call, you know, a personalized surgical approach?
So we adopted that model using R0, meaning no visible residual, as the go, no-go kind of decision. So we then, and this was not an easy undertaking, I will tell you, because when you have 21 gynecologic oncologists like we do in our department, getting them all to agree to do it this way was in itself reportable. But we did. We had a retreat, and we got everybody on board and said, listen, we're going to try this. We're going to use this algorithm for screening patients. We're going to validate the scoring system. And what our hope is that we're going to improve outcomes because the R0 rates will increase in both groups, not only the neoadjuvant group, but also in the primary surgery group. So that's what that figure is representing. What we needed, though, is we needed some type of quality control. So that's why there's a second surgeon built into that algorithm. We started this algorithm in April of 2013. And so every case that was taken to the OR who had a scope had two independent reviewers of the degree of the tumor that was in the peritoneal cavity. And so we assessed that against seven specific points, and each of those got either a zero or a two. For patients that had eight or higher, those patients were then triaged to neoadjuvant chemotherapy, and those was a score of zero, two, or four, or six were then triaged to primary surgery.
What did you see in terms of consistency of the first and second opinions?
Oh, that's great. I'm glad you asked that question. We actually reported this at the SGO. So if your listeners want to go back and look at that, they're certainly welcome to look at our slides from that. Alpa Nick was the primary presenter. So we found an amazing consistency. And we did this a couple ways. The first was to see whether or not the go, no go. So in other words, the neoadjuvant versus primary surgery benchmark was reached. So there was exact agreement on the scoring in about 50 to 60%. But in terms of the triage to surgery versus chemo, it was about 96%. There were only two outliers, essentially, where one surgeon scored in the operable range and the second surgeon scored in the non-operable range. And those were essentially then triaged by a third person. And so the third person would come in and be the arbitrator, and then the decision would stick. And that was part of our agreement amongst our faculty, was that we would follow this algorithm. And if the arbitrator was necessary, we would follow with what the arbitrator said.
How much of whatever difference you did find was the result of sort of different findings at laparoscopy as opposed to interpretation about what to do?
It was more about, like, you probably have seen pictures of the peritoneal cavity of a patient with ovarian cancer. A lot of these discrepancies, and they were usually very narrow. So it was like six by one person and eight on the other. It had to do with the issue of like confluency of disease on the diaphragm or an assessment of whether or not the bowel infiltration was resectable or not resectable. It was those kinds of assessments where one person might have called it a zero and another person would have called it a two. And so otherwise, kind of not huge differences.
What kind of neoadjuvant regimen do you use and what does it accomplish?
So the standard of care for primary ovarian cancer is still a platinum and a taxane doublet. And it's really the nuances are whether or not this should be given intraperitoneally, is it dose dense, In the U.S., for the most part, bevacizumab, which has been approved in Europe in primary setting, is not globally used, mostly because it's not covered by insurances in most states. Particularly here in Texas, it's not covered for use in primary setting. So for most of us, it's either a Q3 weekly or a dose-dense decision for a neoadjuvant patient.
And what does it accomplish? How often do you think patients in a switch from being, you know, what would be residual disease to no residual disease?
Well, that's a great question. And actually, we're looking at that as a specific endpoint for the patients that are going to surgery, you know, after neoadjuvant therapy. You're probably pretty familiar with in breast cancer that this pathologic complete response rate has actually been looked at as a potential accelerated approval option for novel therapies. And the pathologic complete response rate to just chemotherapy after, let's say, 3 or 4 cycles of chemo is very low. It's about 5%. It's been 5% in our hands, and it's been confirmed by one European study that the expectation for response is high, but the expectation for pathologic complete response is actually quite low. So one of the things that we're looking at is when we introduce new treatment into this surgical algorithm is whether or not we can actually adjust that rate up and see if there may be some options for similar accelerated approval therapy.
What about the PathCR rate when you add in Bev?
We don't know. In reality, for patients getting new adjuvant chemotherapy, they'll only get the 2 cycles before surgery because we have to stop the, you know, cycle 3 before the anticipated surgery and won't start it until cycle 5. So cycle 4 in a post-op setting, it would be Bev naive. So we just don't know what that rate is and whether or not it's adjusted by the use.
We're going to talk later on about the exciting development in terms of PARP inhibitors, particularly in BRCA-positive patients, but also ovarian cancer in general. Are there trials or are there any data in neoadjuvant PARP inhibitors?
No, not quite yet with neoadjuvant, but we just launched the first study of a PARP inhibitor being used in combination with paclitaxel and carboplatin. As you know, this has been a really hard thing to do. There was one trial that was done in the recurrent setting, study 41, which was given paclitaxel, carboplatin, and olaparib. And they had to do quite a bit of dose modification to get the triplet in. It's just more toxic, myelosuppressive when it's given that way. But the current trial, GOG-3005, which just launched, is actually combining veliparib in combination with paclitaxel and carboplatin. And that, as I mentioned, just started.
Any interest in sort of chemo followed by PARP inhibitor neoadjuvantly?
Sure. And that's actually the subject of several ongoing trials. The SOLO-1 trial, which is now included accrual, is looking at olaparib as essentially a maintenance treatment.
But again, neoadjuvantly.
Well, it's given in patients who got frontline therapy. And then at the completion of frontline therapy, then they're randomizing.
Any other surgical issues that you want to comment on? Maybe, I'm not going to say mistakes, but myths or misperceptions or things you would do differently when you see people coming in for second opinions.
Yeah, the major thing is that they come in for second opinion. What we're concerned about is that with the availability of these 2 randomized trials, non-inferiority trials showing that chemo and surgery seem to be non-inferior to each other, that there may be a lack of an opinion, a surgical opinion by a gynecologic oncologist. So we're trying to get the message out that, you know, as part of the normal workup, if a patient sees a medical oncologist first, that they at least get an opinion regarding surgery by a gynecologic oncologist to make an assessment as to whether or not surgery is feasible and would be of value in the patient.
These are patients with disease outside the abdomen?
No, not so much that, but, you know, even patients that have pleural effusions, some of those patients have the effusion because of migration of the fluid through the diaphragms. But it's more about when people see a CAT scan of a patient who has diffuse disease in the abdomen, there's kind of a freak out moment. And they say, oh, well, we need to debulk that with chemo first before you go to surgery. But in reality, many of those cases are operable. And that's why we wanted to advocate strongly that these patients be seen by a GYN oncologist first.
Interesting. I would not have guessed that, but that is interesting. Getting back to the issue of neoadjuvant treatment, in other tumors, particularly breast cancer, this setting's been used to look at short-term predictors of response to systemic agents. Anything like that going on in ovarian cancer?
You know, there was a really interesting report that came out at ASCO a couple years ago that identified a cohort of patients who had an immunophenotype that essentially did very poorly when they were given bevacizumab, actually worse than expected. And actually, it's not, you know, now that we know more about what happens with Bev in the microenvironment, that actually makes some sense. And we're actually designing a trial right now, which will hopefully take advantage of that inducible effect of a immunophenotype in the microenvironment that would provide a survival advantage for the cancer cell. So I thought that was quite interesting. It's very hard to reproduce that kind of thing in a per-patient basis. But as a population, it does raise a lot of new hypotheses. Outside of that, we've not been able to come up with, you know, really clear biomarkers. There was a study that was put together looking at the GOG-218 study that was looking at, you know, levels of VEGF to see if this could be predictive of outcome. And again, there's these associations, but actually identifying on a per-patient basis of who's going to respond and not is still somewhat problematic.
So speaking of bevacizumab, you were involved in some, as you have been for a long time, critical clinical trials looking at that. And at the SGO meeting, you presented a phase 3, or I don't know if you were the one who presented it, but you had the paper, phase 3 randomized trial from the GOG, the 213 study. And then at ASCO, I see that there were more data reported on patient-reported outcomes from this trial. Can you talk about that study and what you think it means?
Yeah, the GOG-213, for those people in the audience who know me, know that that's been my baby for about 10 years, maybe even longer. It's been a long time coming, and it's a very difficult trial to do because it's evaluating two endpoints. It's evaluating the impact of bevacizumab on paclitaxel carboplatin backbone. That's what we reported on at SGO this year and the quality of life. It's also looking at the role of secondary cytoreduction, which is another one of those highly biased, you know, interventions that has yet to have data. So we were the first to essentially launch a randomized trial for surgery in the recurrent platinum-sensitive setting. The trial is still ongoing. We are very near to close the enrollment on the surgical arm. The chemotherapy arm is closed for some time now. And so what I reported at SGO this year was the outcome data for the Bev versus no Bev question. So the other interesting piece about this particular trial is compared to the other trials that have been done in this space with anti-angiogenesis drugs is that this trial's primary endpoint is overall survival. So as you know, the OCEANS trial showed a PFS with no OS difference with adding bevacizumab to gemcitabine and carboplatin. This trial was looking at those outcomes in platinum-sensitive patients with paclitaxel and carboplatin backbone. So essentially what we showed was that there was, you know, as expected, there was a big PFS difference, the hazard ratio about 0.6, and an improvement in that on the median of about 3 months. But what was really remarkable was that in the overall survival, we showed that there was a very nearly statistically significant improvement of about 5 months in overall survival. And the reason I say it was nearly is that the confidence interval for the 95% confidence two-tailed test was at 1.005. So P equal 0.056. So it's very, very close. And I think most of us feel that this is probably clinically meaningful. And so we'll see how this plays out. But there may be something about the taxane Bev combination in recurrent disease that's important, and maybe more important than some of the other combination backbones.
What was the hazard rate for reduction in the improvement in survival?
It was about 0.8283.
And what about the secondary surgery?
So secondary surgery is still ongoing. At the time that we reported the study, we had 107 patients that had participated. One of the things that we realized was that the hazard ratio for the subgroup, this is a pre-planned subgroup of, it's actually a stratification variable, that those patients that went on to surgery actually relative to the whole sample size have a hazard ratio of 0.55. So these are very different patients that are going to surgery. Whether or not there's going to be a benefit with the addition of the chemotherapy strategy on top of that surgical benefit has yet to be determined. But what we're finding is that the events are very extended. So it may be a few more years before I can report on the surgical question.
What's your approach outside a trial setting to secondary cytoreductive surgery?
So I think the retrospective and the very few limited prospective trials that have been reported basically come back to a very simple principle. Surgery doesn't work if the patients aren't chemosensitive. So we know that chemosensitivity is a function of the treatment-free interval after the primary treatment is completed. So the longer the treatment-free interval, the more chemosensitive these patients generally are, and those make the best candidates. The other is that patients that are not optimally, meaning R0 resection, they probably just don't benefit that much. And again, this is probably a function of the, what I just mentioned as the first factor, which is that long treatment-free interval. So patients with limited sites of disease and long treatment-free intervals are the ones that I feel are the best candidates. Now, that varies among different people. In my mind, I like to see patients that are outside of what our median, you know, progression-free survival is, which is somewhere between 12 and 18 months. So I like to see somebody after 18 months who has, you know, one or two or three sites of disease that can be completely resected.
What is the current role in your own practice outside a trial setting of bevacizumab in ovarian cancer?
I would say that the majority of the use that we have in my practice is in the resistant setting, mainly because it's also FDA approved on the basis of the Aurelia trial. And I tend to use it a lot with weekly paclitaxel or in combination with gemcitabine and cisplatin. And the reason I like that specific triplet combination with the gem-cis in resistant patients is that you can give the gemcitabine and the cisplatin on a 2-week schedule so that you take advantage of the drug-drug synergy that those two drugs have. And then you can add the Bev on a Q2-week schedule as well. So they get essentially all three drugs every 2 weeks.
Any situations where you would use it upfront?
Well, if we could, we just can't get it reimbursed. I still think if I could have it reimbursed, I probably would still use it on frontline setting patients that weren't on trial. I still think that our best shot at making anybody go into durable remission is the very first time they see treatment. So that would be the way to go.
Let's talk a little bit about PARP inhibitors, and you've been involved with research on several. You, again, at SGO, had a paper looking at olaparib monotherapy in patients with germline BRCA mutations. You were also a part of a study looking at veliparib, another PARP inhibitor, again, in breast cancer it's been looked at. And then also a couple of papers, one just at the ASCO meeting, an oral presentation on rucaparib. Can you talk about these three agents, what you learned from these studies, and where you think things are heading?
Well, I think, you know, the use of PARP drugs is a really exciting, you know, aspect of ovarian cancer management at this point. I think probably the most exciting piece of this is that we know these drugs have single agent activity in the patients who are most likely to respond. Those would be the germline carriers or the somatic mutation carriers of BRCA1/2 mutation. What's interesting is that there's probably a bigger audience out there for whom these drugs would be of benefit. And there are some very cool combination strategies that are being developed and I think also provide some new opportunities to move this whole field forward. So yeah, I think that in terms of these drugs, probably the most frequent question I get, because we're also working with talazoparib, I think the most frequent question I get is like, what distinguishes these drugs? And that's actually quite hard. I mean, you know, if you add niraparib in the, that gives us a total of 5, you know, different agents that we are working with. They seem to all have activity in patients that carry germline mutation. There's a little subtlety in the difference of to what degree they induce a PARP trapping type of mechanism of action. But I think overall, all of them, with the exception of veliparib, have been very difficult to give in combination with full-dose chemotherapy. So the development plan is basically following what olaparib have gone, which is look at it first in patients who have the vulnerability, so the BRCA mutation carriers, and then to try to expand that audience as a single agent for those that carry homologous recombination deficiency aberrations.
So when you talk about homologous recombination deficiency, are you talking about a specific assay or you just kind of treat everybody? What is the difference in response, for example, to what you see with germline mutations and without?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think that the data are emerging with the other drugs. The one I know the most about, because we've got the data, it was actually prospectively designed, is the rucaparib trial. So in that rucaparib in the ARIEL-2 trial, which is what we reported, what we did in that trial is we took a cohort. It was, you know, essentially open to all comers with platinum-sensitive disease. So they had to have platinum-sensitive disease. And then we had 3 kind of buckets, if you will. We had a bucket of patients who carried germline or somatic mutation and BRCA, and we capped that enrollment at 40 patients because we knew that we wouldn't need very many patients to show that there was efficacy there. But then we left the trial open for the next 180 or so, 170 patients, to sort out whether or not there was a biomarker that could use to distinguish them. And in this particular assay, what they were looking for was loss of heterozygosity across the genome. So the strategy was that, and I thought this is really interesting, this is probably important for your listeners to know, is that there's probably 40 or so genes that are involved in homologous recombination, and they're broad. For instance, P10 is implicated as a gene that's involved in homologous recombination. It's part of the sequence of events that are important for that kind of, you know, high fidelity DNA repair. But not all of those genes, when they're isolated, are actually sensitive to a PARP. And one of the things that we saw early on was that there was a wide spectrum of sensitivity, you know, the synthetic lethality that you get by knocking out any one of those HRD genes is not the same. So what we decided to do, at least in the ARIEL trial, was to look more globally. Rather than focus just on the genes that are involved in HRD, look across the whole genome for the amount of scarring. It almost falls into that MSI kind of idea that we're seeing now with the immune therapies. You know, you look at a global inability to repair. And so that's what they showed, was that when we looked at the response rate in the patients that were low loss of heterozygosity and non-carrier of BRCA mutation, the response rates were very low, about 10%. In the patients that had the BRCA mutations, of course, the response rates were very high, and all those patients had high LOH. But the patients that were wild type for BRCA, either in germline or tumor, but had high LOH, they had an intermediate response, about 40%. So it showed that, you know, that's a pretty decent response rate to a drug in a patient that doesn't carry a BRCA mutation. And so that's where I think these other, and this isn't unique to the rucaparib program, but it's obviously going to be repeated in the others.
What about clinical tolerability? You know, we are hearing people now that olaparib is out there talk about GI problems. What do we know about these various PARP inhibitors and side effects?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, it was one of those things that you learned when you treated your first patient and they were calling you back in a couple of days that they were having all this problem. So we learned early on that we needed to anticipate that. So I would say that right now we still get those problems from time to time, but we provide the ammo for the patients to take care of it ahead of time. We counsel them extensively about what it is so that they anticipate that it could be coming on and have them start medicating themselves right away so they can take care of the GI side effects.
I'm always curious about people's individual cocktails. What exactly do you do? And what about the other PARP inhibitors? They cause the same problem.
Yeah, it's a class effect. We see it across the whole spectrum. And every single one of the drugs I've worked with, we've seen it as a problem. I just think we've gotten better at it. We give them ondansetron either as a slow release or as the pill form. We give them compazine. And it's mostly not so much necessarily the cocktail as it is the anticipation. So the patients just have to have that second sense about when they think they might be nauseated. Because remember, these are lots of pills. It's not like it's one pill and you get through it. You got to take several of these pills. You know, the olaparib formulation before it went to the tablet, it was taking a lot of capsules twice a day. So, you know, if you have a GI side effect, it's a hard thing to do to stay on drug. And this is, like I said, it's a class effect. So we use that and we use aggressive education and do it that way.
What about the anemia? Is that also a class effect? And how exactly do you deal with it?
Well, we see it a little bit. I haven't yet had to transfuse somebody, and I've had several patients on for a long period of time. We do see some transient anemia. Some of the drugs, it's a little more than the others. I mean, I guess we'll see this when we see the full spectrum of the clinical data, but we have seen that there might be a little bit of a differential between the drugs with regard to that and also with myelosuppression. We've seen some of the drugs myelosuppression. But, you know, in reality, when you get to that dose, it's really a dose effect, and all the drugs can produce all those side effects if you get to the right dose.
Let's talk a little bit about your cases, and maybe we could start out with the cervical patient because we've talked a lot about ovary, but why don't we start out with your 37-year-old lady?
Yeah, so, you know, this was a patient who was diagnosed with the stage 1B1 squamous cell carcinoma of the cervix, and she had what a lot of patients would have for this, and that's a radical surgery to remove the uterus and the lymph nodes, and she had negative margins and negative nodes and did well for about 2 years. And then came back and presented with this hoarse cough and vague abdominal pain. And as you know, most patients, anything that looks as a deviation from their normal setting brings them in, and that's indeed what happened. We did do a PET CT, and she had suspected disease that was extending all the way up the chain, and she had a mass in the lateral pelvis that was associated to the sidewall. And, you know, a lot of people will ask, well, how could that happen? I mean, you had a radical strike with negative margins, and you had negative nodes, so how did it happen? And what we're coming to realize is that, you know, there is probably this issue of a stem cell that does reflect this particular tumor, and there's also several nodes that are essentially not potentially in the nodal chains that are resected. So we still are using relatively imprecise methodologies, although I will say, and the reason I wanted to bring this particular case in, is that we're doing a lot more sentinel node mapping now with cervical cancer. It's a story that we've been looking at for more than a decade, but I think that the experience is starting to gain that we're finding some of these lymph nodes in weird places. And so that's probably what happened here, that there was a node in the area that was missed, maybe above the surgical field as well, because the periaortics aren't necessarily always looked at if the pelvic nodes are negative. And in a 2-year period of time, she had growth of tumor.
That's interesting about the sentinel nodes. So if the sentinel nodes are negative, you don't pursue dissection?
Well, what we're doing right now is we're trying to validate the sentinel node thing. So yes, right now we're still doing the nodes, and then we're also doing the basins to make sure that we'll know what the false negative, false positive rates are.
How often do you see disease outside the pelvis at first relapse?
You know, it follows the rules of thirds. So about a third of the time it's in the pelvis, a third of the time it's outside of the pelvis, and a third of the time it includes both. So it's kind of that same mixture.
So before you talk about what happened to her, which is that she went on a trial, I want to hear about that. But outside a clinical trial setting, how would you analyze the decision options at this point?
You know, it's a great question for cervix cancer patients because we know these patients are very difficult to achieve not only response, but certainly very uncommon that they'll actually be cured of their recurrence. So the decision, it really comes down to the same decisions we make with any of our patients that we induce a therapy on, and that's to look at the risk-benefit for institution of therapy. The difference in cervix cancer is that the response rates are just not that great, and their expected survivorship is also limited, you know, relative to some of the other more chemosensitive diseases we deal with, like endometrial and ovarian cancer. So that's a really fair question. And when I counsel patients, I always tell them that I got to be their advocate on this. And if I don't feel that the treatment's actually going to benefit them versus the toxicity, that it's not worth doing.
So if the patient is going to be treated, what kind of treatment do you think would be standard in this situation?
Well, fortunately, now we have FDA approval for the use of bevacizumab with chemotherapy. And that's why I put down that she was treated on GOG-240 because it was the trial that led to that approval. And it was a very nice trial that was looking at the use of bevacizumab or not in two different chemotherapy backbones. The other piece that's interesting in this case that was reflective in the trial was that she had a long duration of time before her first recurrence. This has kind of showed up as a cofactor among the history of chemotherapy and cervix cancer. There seems to be a potential treatment-free interval where patients who have longer off-treatment exposure might actually respond better to a platinum retreatment.
What was the time point at which she was diagnosed with recurrence and put onto the trial? How long ago?
It's about 2 years or so now.
And can you talk about what happened?
So basically, we put her on treatment, and she actually got a complete response, which was remarkable. We were very excited. One of the differences in this particular case is you might see in a normal situation is that the patients might have had chemo radiation to begin with, and then they're retreated. And what we know in that situation is that patients that have chemotherapy and radiation who are treated with chemotherapy again, there's a differential of response for in-field and out-of-field failures. So the response rates in general are higher in patients who have out-of-field recurrences. So they're not limited by the poor vascularity of a chemoradiation area. So this patient wasn't a good candidate for radiation because she had such diffuse disease from the pelvis to the neck. And so while you could use radiation as a palliative modality for, you know, the pelvic disease, she essentially had a chemo-naive state. And that's why I think she had such a good response to treatment. So she did have a complete response to therapy and actually went NED for about another year and change, and then ultimately recurred and then went on to, you know, really a very short list of ineffective treatment.
I'm just kind of curious, though, in terms of this issue about the radiation, to what extent does prior radiation affect the ability to dose the drug in terms of marrow tolerance?
Yeah, that's a great question. Oh, my gosh. This comes up a lot, and I think that it's underappreciated by a lot of people, so I'm glad you brought it up. Yeah, it depends on how much of the marrow was radiated. I think when the pelvis is radiated, you're getting up close to that 20% of the marrow reserve if they get standard pelvic field for cervix cancer curative treatment. So that's a pretty big chunk of the marrow reserve that these patients have. It's worse if they get periaortic radiation as well, so the extended fields. So yes, it can affect the dosing. In these trials, we have abbreviated the dose a bit so that they could get the therapy repetitively. The one thing I'll say is that unlike ovarian and endometrial cancer, the expectation to get 6 cycles of treatment is actually quite a bit lower.
So I'm curious, when she went into CR with the chemo bev, did her hoarseness get better?
Yeah, no, so that improved because that happened to be a recurrent laryngeal nerve kind of impingement from the nodal thing. In fact, that was one of the very first things she noticed, or at least I noticed, is that I said, wait a minute, your voice isn't as hoarse anymore. She's like, yeah, it seems to be getting better.
What did you do upon progression after having this great response? And are there any situations, you know, this is a big debate, particularly in colon cancer, there's even a trial looking at continuing Bev on progression and changing the chemo. Any situations where you ever do that? And what was her next therapy?
Well, that's a good question. And we're actually investigating that in an ovarian trial right now as well. In cervix cancer, you know, what we will typically do and what we do with her is we basically kind of keep her on this until intolerance. And I think in this case, we kept her on bevacizumab, but she developed some problems with it, and then we had to take her off. There was a period of time where she was just being observed. When she recurred, I think my first kind of step was to go back to a platinum combo, but something different than with paclitaxel. So I used the gemcitabine cisplatinum regimen that I had mentioned before for cervix cancer. And, you know, it worked a little bit, I would say. I mean, we went through one assessment cycle without progression, but then it looked like it had progressed through, and then we put her into a phase one program.
Interesting. You mentioned that she had some kind of problem with Bev. What was the problem, and what kinds of problems do you see in general in these patients?
Well, in general, for cervix cancer patients, you know, most of these we see with recurrent disease have had radiation, so we see complications from that frequently. In this particular situation, it wasn't that. We were running into problems with proteinuria. Actually, I tried to dose reduce the Bev, actually, because I do think there's a dose response to some of the side effects that we see, certainly with hypertension and with the proteinuria. But, you know, it was kind of one of those things. She was kind of getting worn out just from the chemotherapy exposure. This was kind of an additional annoyance. And that kind of just led to us to finally say, listen, I don't know how much benefit we're getting out of this. We've done it for several cycles. And then that's how we kind of came to the decision to stop.
That's interesting. Did she have hypertension also?
Yeah, but it wasn't something that was unmanageable. She was on a single drug.
It's interesting. You don't hear too many patients with significant proteinuria on Bev in any cancer, although occasionally you've heard about people even going into the nephrotic range, and you get into this question of, you know, well, now they're benefiting from treatment, but how big a deal is it to be nephrotic? How bad was her proteinuria?
Well, like I said, it was more of an annoyance. So I wouldn't say it was the thing that was dose limiting. It's just that it was, you know, in the constellation of the symptoms and the treatment course and all that, we just decided to take a break.
What about bowel perforation? And as long as I'm bringing it up, bowel perforation also with ovarian.
Actually, in cervix cancer, what we see even probably more so is fistula. So, you know, they're already at risk because of the poor vascularity, and we do see that. And I've seen several cases where they've developed fistula on Bev, on 240-like regimens, and then we've stopped the Bev, and the fistula is actually healed, or at least got to be less of a nuisance. The bowel perforation risk across the GYN spectrum is still coming in around 2 to 4% when it's done in the right patients. I think we learned early on that, you know, women with inflammatory bowel disease and those that have bowel obstruction are terrible candidates for the drug, and I absolutely don't use it in those situations. So I think the more selective that we've become, the lower the rate of the adverse event.
How about your 71-year-old lady with endometrial cancer?
So she's 71. She kind of came in with the usual postmenopausal bleeding, and a biopsy showed a grade 2 endometrioid type tumor. And interestingly, she also had these bilateral ovarian masses that were present on her imaging, and unfortunately some omental thickening. And so before I had seen her, she had gone to the operating room, and she was found with this grade 2 lesion that was invading into the myometrium by 2/3, and she had some lymphovascular space involvement. And in the ovaries, she had a similar grade 2 endometrioid tumor that was on the surface. And so it was felt to be, rather than a synchronous primary, as a metastatic deposit. And of course, she had disease in the omentum. So when I saw her, this had already been done. And the imaging, when I saw her, also showed she had some ascites and had some peritoneal disease. And the ascites was actually somewhat problematic. She was wanting it tapped. It was more of a, you know, it was heaviness and all that. So I saw her essentially as a second opinion regarding treatment, and she had been given the recommendation of paclitaxel carboplatin. And so when I saw her, I told her that would be a completely reasonable thing to do. We have a lot of data to support that. But I also had a trial ongoing, which was looking at the role of dasatinib in combination with paclitaxel carboplatin. And so she went on to that trial.
What was the rationale for dasatinib?
We've had a lot of interest in the specific target called FA2, EphrinA2. And FA2 is a very unique target for a lot of cancer biology because it's lost. It's a part of neuronal development in the fetal tissues, but it's lost in adult tissues except in cancers. It's also activated. It has activity essentially in a phosphorylated and a non-phosphorylated state. And so we started a program about 10 years ago trying to find a way to target the specific protein and the specific gene because it was so prevalent in a number of different tumors and seemed to drive a lot of biology for invasion and metastasis.
And what's your current situation?
So the way this trial was written, and we haven't reported this yet, but I'll just give you the highlight of this trial. The way I wrote this trial was that the dasatinib was actually given as an induction. So they got one course of dasatinib as a single agent, and they were biopsied before and after, before they started the chemotherapy triplet. And so she went on, you know, she had her ascites was a problem. The first cycle of dasatinib, we didn't see much change there, but it didn't get worse. And then when she went on the chemotherapy, the ascites dried up. And when we looked at her after three cycles of chemotherapy, she'd had a dramatic improvement in her peritoneal disease. And then at the end of six cycles, she had even more, although not a complete response at the completion of that. And she went on to three more cycles of the chemotherapy.
What's her current situation?
So right now, she's still on treatment with Pectascar Platinum and continuing to do quite well. You know, as I mentioned, she's ERPR positive, which is a little unusual, but this provides an opportunity for another intervention that we're closely working on now as well.
What's that?
That's looking at the use of everolimus, letrozole, and metformin, which we've now shown in several of our kind of sequential studies to have be quite active in patients who have endometrioid ER-positive tumors.
That's really interesting. And of course, we've seen a lot of excitement in breast cancer with the CDK inhibitors, palbociclib, really impressive results at the ASCO meeting. It's already approved. There's another one. What about CDK inhibitors in endometrial cancer?
Absolutely. So our next trial, once we close the everolimus letrozole metformin trial, is to one with a CDK4 inhibitor.
So there's so many things to talk about today. We only got through about like two-thirds of them. The one thing I did want to ask you about, because you submitted a couple cases of ovarian cancer, and I was curious about this first one, the 60-year-old lady, for one particular reason, is that she got a whole bunch of therapies, you know, without going into all the details. This is over a period of years. And only very late in the game, so to speak, had BRCA mutation testing. And I'm curious whether, you know, you consider BRCA testing standard of care as soon as you have a patient with ovarian cancer.
I do. No question.
So you might find it interesting that when we were at your group, the SGO meeting last year, and we polled an audience of quite a few people, only 75%. Does that sound possible?
Yeah, it is. I think the message is trickling out. And again, some of that may be qualified too. So I would qualify and say that the non-mucinous ovarian cancer patients should be tested. Yes, I do. The availability of therapy and even strategy, I wouldn't even say even with outside of the PARP inhibitors, just strategy is going to be dependent on that. So yes, we need to get the word out.
We actually had a case of a patient who had been referred to hospice and had not been BRCA tested, got BRCA tested and responded to olaparib. In this situation, again, it looks like she got to you fairly late in the game.
So, you know, it was just remarkable. And this is a good message for, you know, anybody who's treating a patient. When you see somebody who's received this much platinum and responded this many times, there's something going on. Even if they're not BRCA positive in the germline, there's something else going on here. And so I had a high, obviously high index of suspicion. And, you know, so we tested her and found out that yes, indeed, she was a carrier.
And how long ago was that?
You know, this was about 2-3 years ago now.
Interesting. So what happened at that point?
So, you know, at the time we didn't have olaparib to give off trial, but we were able to get her into one of our PARP trials. She was like one of the two that we could recruit before the study closed. And she developed a response to this, even though, you know, it was so long afterwards with all the prior treatment that she had had.
And what happened subsequently?
So ultimately she did progress, but you know, her performance status was actually still fairly good and her volume of disease was still relatively small. So she went on to, I actually kind of recycled through some of these regimens she had before because, you know, these direct DNA damaging agents actually are quite active in patients who carry the BRCA mutation. So I recycled through the gemcitabine and the platinum.